Hello and welcome to Talent Takes Time, a podcast to help you on your career journey into sports media. I'm Alison Bender, a freelance football presenter, and I speak to people I know within the industry about how they got there and the lessons they have learnt along the way. In this series, as well as talking to presenters and writers, I wanted to speak to some of the key decision makers, those who'll be selecting the talent of tomorrow, to find out just what they're looking for. In this episode, I speak to Anna Kessel. At the time of recording, Anna was the women's sport editor at The Telegraph. Anna has recently announced that she has left that post, and what a legacy she's left behind, helping to put women's sport firmly on the agenda. Anna is also an author. I read her book, Eat, Sweat, Play, an exploration of women's relationship with sport and how they are finally reclaiming it. I just love this book. I laughed at her many references to growing up in the 80s and 90s and cried as she spoke of her miscarriage. But come the end of it, I felt like I wanted to go for a long, hard run in the rain after Anna's own recollections. And this is from someone who hates running. So I would highly recommend you read this book. So many people ask me, how do you become a sports journalist? And the truth is, there is no one way. I just loved Anna's honesty, as she told me that when she entered the industry, she had a lot of passion, but very little actual experience.
I had a bit of an odd pathway. I had really no experience in journalism and no qualifications at all. I just knew that I was a bit mad about sport and I loved writing. And I wrote to all of the main national newspapers in the country and asked if I could come and do work experience. And only one replied, that was The Observer. And I was very lucky that there was a very supportive desk administrator there called Vicky Barrett, who really took me under her wing. I think she spotted that there weren't many women coming through and she wanted to champion me. And started off doing work experience and didn't really leave for another 15 years.
I think that will be quite heartening for some people, Anna, because a lot of people, they contact me and they say, you know, do I need to have a degree in journalism? What do I have to do? And the one thing I think about is that every single guest that I've interviewed on this series, they all have a very different pathway. But as a decision maker yourself, what do you look for in CVs? Are you always looking for the same thing? Or, you know, will you take people with very different routes and different pathways?
I'm definitely open to all different types of talent and different types of experience. I think that, you know, when I was coming through, there was a well-worn pathway of you start at a regional and then you work your way up to a national. And, you know, and it was very kind of set and formalised. But in the modern day where people are accessing media in so many different ways, a lot of people are doing their own blogs and podcasts and, you know, there are so many more multifaceted ways to show your skill. That I think it's really important for employers to be much more flexible.
That's great. Is there one thing out there that you think can and put someone, make them stand out from the crowd? What sort of thing do you look for? Like you say, is it doing blogs? Is it doing YouTube channels, that kind of thing?
It's not so much what they're doing, although obviously that's part of it, because you need to see that they're doing something and doing it well. But it's more how original it is, because I have a lot of people contact me and they say, oh, I cover football or I cover netball. Let me know if you want anything. But they're not really offering up what it is about them that makes them stand out. They're not sending me an amazing piece of work where I read the intro and I go, oh my God, that's an amazing introduction and I want to read the next 900 words. So it's those kind of nuggets of what can you offer that's really unique to you and different to what everybody else has.
I agree with this piece of advice, and this is where I want to encourage you to sell yourself properly. When you cold email a company who won't know you, you need to tell them why they should hire you. Don't waste your time telling them why you want them, because frankly, they know that. It's all about what you can do for them. That's why experience in a niche and passion is so important. Find something you love and share that enthusiasm in a unique way. Experience is everything. Yet one of the questions I get asked most about is formal education.
I'm just wondering about the basics, because a lot of people say to me, what GCSEs, what A-levels, what degrees? Do you think it almost doesn't matter for certainly for the GCSEs or the A-levels?
Oh, God, no. No, and I think you need a wide wealth of experience in this world. You know, you need to do all sorts of different jobs. You need to be a waitress or work in McDonald's or work in a shop and have, you know, a wide, diverse knowledge of the world, because sport really is a microcosm of the rest of the world. And if you don't understand people, if you don't understand different cultures, if you're not able to communicate, then you're not going to get very far in sports journalism.
I just love this piece of advice and I too would second it. Formal education is not the be-all and end-all, and some people are not so privileged to benefit from a degree, so it's refreshing that Anna and The Telegraph are so open-minded. When I look back at my own career, selling double glazing and cold calling taught me a great lesson in rejection. Waitressing taught me how to deal with difficult customers. Bar work taught me about working under pressure in unsociable hours. Each and every one of those was every bit as important to me as working my way up and learning the ropes in a production company or getting good grades at school. So take those jobs, work hard, learn graft and grit, and become worldly.
When you look at young people now, I think they have so much to contend with, obviously social media, so much pressure on them. What can you tell those young people starting out on their journeys? And perhaps what do you wish you could have told your younger self starting out on your journey?
Well, first of all, I would say that print sports journalism is a very aged population. And so having young, fresh talent coming into the workplace is absolutely crucial, because we see how young sports stars are using social media, are using these platforms that a lot of older people don't either use or are not familiar with or maybe haven't even heard of. So their skill set as young people is absolutely crucial to making sports journalism work. That's the first thing. The second thing I would say is that I wish I'd had somebody to help me through the kind of stresses and impact of working in sports media, which is an incredibly kind of charged, quite toxic masculinity a lot of the time. I had people supporting me and championing me, but I don't think I had somebody who I could really talk to about my feelings and about how, you know, when things didn't go well, when somebody made unpleasant comments to me or inappropriate advances, I didn't know what to do with those things. And there was very much this attitude from the older generation of, you just have a thick skin, you work hard and you get on with it. And no sort of real acknowledgement that those experiences can actually damage you. They can damage your confidence and they can stop your progression. They can slow down your trajectory. And I think both as an employer, I don't want to see that happening to young people, but also as a young person, I want them to feel emboldened to know that that isn't normal and that isn't right. And it's not on them to just have a thick skin.
It's bad how we just accept what we need to put up with rather than trying to stop it. So I'm pleased Anna has adopted a zero tolerance towards that type of behaviour. When I spoke to the former editor of the News of the World, Paul McCarthy, in Series 1, he told me the paper provided a career advisor, come counsellor or therapist. I think so many companies would benefit from similar. As Anna said, we're just a little bit more worn down by these experiences and perhaps a little less trusting of the world and the industry. Thankfully for you today, there are two wonderful organisations that help with this type of thing. The FWA, the Football Writers Association, and Women in Football, or WIF. Anna was one of the founder members of WIF and explained to me how it all began.
So Women in Football was born out of those early experiences as a young reporter going out to match days or press conferences and having really unpleasant encounters. Sometimes I think they were unconscious or unintentional on the part of the other person, you know, asking if I am a journalist or if I was waiting for my boyfriend, the footballer, that sort of thing. I mean, I definitely am not as glam as a footballer's other half, I can tell you that. But yeah, just, you know, that kind of unintentional bias. But then sometimes it was intentional. And sometimes people would really, you know, cross a line and make me feel very uncomfortable and use a lot of sexualized language and things like that, which you shouldn't have to come up against in the workplace. So that sowed the seed for wanting to start the network Women in Football, which I did with Shelley Alexander, who was at the BBC at the time. And the idea was really to support women coming through the industry so that we could talk about these things, have somewhere to share experiences and exchange professional advice, but also use the organisation to kind of try and lobby for change to make it better for the next generation.
WIF run courses and mentoring programmes. I've been involved in some myself, helping young women to realise their dreams. As for the FWA, be sure to become a member. They will connect you with other sports journalists and support you in your career. I collaborated with the FWA to produce a free ebook with tips and advice about entering the industry. If you'd like a copy, sign up on my website, alisonbender.com, and I'll send you it. One of the questions I get asked about the most from journalism students is how people can find work experience. So I asked Anna her advice.
I think work experience is crucial. I mean, I was lucky that I got to do mine straight in at the deep end at The Observer, so on a national newspaper. But it's not like I walked in and started interviewing Premier League footballers on my first day. You know, I was sent to do all sorts of things. I remember being sent down Ridley Road Market to survey 100 people about tennis, which was hilarious. I did the results on the production side of things, working long days on match days, inputting data. I called up fans in League Two after their matches and asked them how it had gone, and then wrote up the little interviews. You know, it was all of those things that together helped to build a much more kind of solid and rounded picture of what strong journalism is. Strong journalism isn't just a story, which in itself is a whole conversation, but all the things that go around it to make that final product that the reader gets. And it gave me a really good understanding of how a desk works, you know, from the writers to the editors, to the sub-editors, to the designers, the picture desk, all of those components work together to make a newspaper.
Anna is right. It's all about understanding the full picture and feeling comfortable in a newspaper, radio or TV environment, which can at first appear chaotic. I know it's hard. I too spent a long time trying to gain experience in the workplace. For myself, I began at a local radio station, Kingston Hospital Radio, where I'd wander around the wards asking people for their favourite songs for my request show. I also had a film review show where I'd hire out videos from Blockbuster and write a short review that I'd later read out. It was hard work every Friday night when my mates were out drinking, and it was unpaid too, but it gave me the experience I needed to move up to the next level. I know that you must have had huge hurdles and challenges. You've spoken about some of them. What would you say has been the biggest challenge as a journalist and as an editor in your whole journey?
Yeah, I think all those little nibbles or tiny chunks that were taken out of me along the way that I probably didn't realise at the time. I was so busy putting on my brave face and my thick skin and carrying on with it as I was told I should be doing. I didn't realise it was kind of eating away a bit at my self-belief and my confidence. And I think that's a shame. Looking back, I see that now, the impact that had. But I think probably the biggest hurdle was becoming a mother, because then that wasn't about kind of having to put a brave face on. That was just a blatant structural impasse. You know, I had a young baby, and how on earth was I going to make it work in an industry that's very 24/7 and very drop of a hat. And some of it you can manage. You know, I wrote tons of copy with a baby jiggling on my knee, or, you know, working it around their nap time, or while I was on maternity leave, or whatever those things were. Some of that is doable, but then there's also, you know, traveling, long days. Unless you have a kind of live-in nanny and have a fortune in the bank to pay for it, it is really hard. And I'd really, really like to see the industry change. You know, sport talks about wanting more women involved, but you've got to have the actions to back that up. Are you going to make the workplace a friendly and flexible place for parents?
I don't know where to begin on this one. Motherhood was the biggest shock for me too. I'd been so busy building my career, I hadn't had the chance to think about what my job might look like when I had children. I wrote my first article for a newspaper whilst in a play cafe because the opportunity was dropped on me last minute and I felt I didn't want to pass it up. I spent 6 weeks away at a World Cup and I missed my baby's first steps. Of course, men experience this too, and I discuss it on Series 1. It's tough, but women have extra things to deal with. I had to express my breast milk in football toilets, experienced a miscarriage whilst at West Ham, and had to deal with being pregnant and fearing a ball might get kicked at me while I watched at the training ground. And I panted breathlessly when 8 months pregnant, as my uterus expanded and I had no room to take a deep breath, but I wanted to continue presenting live TV. That's my job. And then after the birth, I lugged around a heavy, aching body that hadn't been given time to fully recover so I could get back to work. Thankfully, Anna had some small crumb of comfort for those getting into the industry who might want a family.
One bright silver lining that I've seen at the Telegraph, which is so positive, is paternity leave, 6 months paternity leave for dads. I think that's an wonderful. Absolute, it's just a game changer. We've had our sports editor go on 6 months. We've had our sports news editor go. We've got our deputy sports website editor about to go, writers production. I mean, I've just never seen anything like it. And for men to go and have that experience as dads is obviously very enriching for them. But I think also the experience that they then bring back of parenting into the workplace is really crucial.
That's just incredible. Is that normal? Is that something very unique to the Telegraph? Do you know about some of the other papers? Are they similar, or is this quite groundbreaking?
I've never heard of it anywhere else, and you know, I've been in earshot of other conversations around people going on maternity or paternity, and it's all kind of built around, oh, what an absolute hassle this is and how inconvenient to the workplace. So I think it's just wonderful that the Telegraph are doing it, and I think it's really groundbreaking.
You talk about more women putting themselves forward. We've spoken about this so many times, haven't we, that a woman will always find the reasons why they don't think they can do the job, whereas the man will usually put themselves forward and big up the things that they do have. What can you say to women listening to this, thinking about applying for a job and thinking perhaps they don't quite have what it takes? There's so much imposter syndrome out there. I speak to women all the time who just don't think they're good enough.
Yeah, I mean, that's not unique to sport, is it? It's just, it's a norm, it's a cultural norm. And I think the problem with this conversation is that we so often kind of turn it back on the women and say, come on, be a bit more confident, just put yourself out there. You know, if you don't put yourself in, then you've got no chance. But in a way, we're kind of gaslighting women through doing that, because the reason why women are hesitant is because they know the risks of putting themselves out there. They know that the kind of knockbacks, they know that it's not necessarily a safe space for them to put themselves forward, because so many women have shared their experiences of when they do put their hand up and how that's received. So, you know, we've got to work very hard, I'm saying now as an employer and as an editor, to make the workplace better and more accommodating for women. And we have to show them and promise them that we will keep them safe through that. And I completely get why women don't put their hands up. I mean, if you think about some of the early tasks that I had, which was very much like non-league grounds, travelling to remote places that were not well connected, certainly not well lit, you know, through the winter football season, thinking about working in the dark at night time and all of the, you know, fears and concerns that we have now because of things like Sarah Everard and so many others. Those are well-founded fears and concerns. Yeah. That probably aren't going through young men's heads when they're being asked to go to, I don't know, Maidenhead on a Tuesday night or whatever it is.
Yeah, it's sad, isn't it? It's unsafe. It's intimidating. I guess the more we speak about it, the more men can have an understanding and an appreciation, hopefully. I always end on biggest tips, and I know there are so many. Many people think, I love sport, I love football, this is the perfect job for me. And I think this series is as much about putting people off as encouraging people, because I think you have to be the right person, right? What are your biggest tips, and what can you tell someone who loves sport, who thinks they want to get into this industry?
I suppose I've got two pieces of advice to any young men who are listening. This is not, you are not going to be sent to Old Trafford next week. So get that out of your head now. Because every time I've worked with young people, so many young men, that's their expectation. And they're a bit disappointed when they get sent somewhere else. So that would be my advice to those people that don't get that you've got to put in the hard graft. But I suppose to women and a lot of underrepresented groups, it's a different piece of advice, really, because I don't think they often don't have those expectations, frankly. And I think it's more about asking for help and not being afraid to not know the answer to stuff. Some of the best senior operators in this industry that I've worked with have been really transparent about saying, actually, I don't know about that story, or can you explain that to me, or I don't quite understand that. I think that's such a strength to not know something, but still obviously remain curious and want to know more about it. So asking for help and flagging when you're uncomfortable about something, making sure that you have those tools around you to succeed, it's really important.
This reminded me of two of my guests from season one. NBC's Rebecca Lowe told me, you need to know you have to start at the bottom and work your way up. And Jackie Oatley, football commentator and presenter, told me that work should be seen as a privilege, whatever it is, however simple. So many young people contact me on TikTok after seeing my behind the scenes video. Wow, this is my dream job. I'm going to do this too, they might say. Perhaps forgetting it took a good 10 to 15 years before I was allowed to regularly get out on the road and interview players. It's not to say it's impossible, but you have to love the tough stuff too. You have to have that mindset. You may not get near a Premier League game for the first decade of your career, and that's the truth. it's very difficult, I think, to trust people. So I remember being at Sky Sports News as a young reporter, 2006, and the editor there said to me, oh, any questions, anything, even if it seems silly, you've got to ask. And I remember asking, I was a bit unsure of how to pronounce Pittodrie. And I was umming and ahhing, do I ask, don't I ask? And I thought, you know what, I don't want to get it wrong on national television. So I asked. And the next day I was brought into the boss's office and they said, we think this job's too big for you because you should know how to pronounce Pittodrie. And I felt broken. And it's little things like that. I almost feel like everyone's on watch of, is this woman going to get it wrong? Does she know enough? And it's about sort of building up that confidence and having the right people around you, isn't it?
Isn't that ridiculous? And doesn't that say so much about the old, you know, the old order of this industry and what needs to change? Because for me, somebody who puts their hands up to check, and how many times, by the way, have we heard on live broadcast somebody mispronouncing somebody's name or a word? Constantly. And we all say, shouldn't they get it right and know how to say it? And that's exactly what you were trying to do. No,
it
that haunts enrages me.
I have to say, it haunts and enrages me. And it makes me really sad for that young girl who was live on air, literally sweating, thinking, do I or don't I? But I think the key is, like you were saying, you've got organisations now like Women in Football. You have people, you have supporters, you have people championing you. And it's about having those right people around you.
One thing I'll say in addition to this is that thankfully your experience allows you to learn the difference between an acceptable and an unacceptable question. And so the biggest takeaway is that experience is everything. Don't forget, people like Anna are in charge of employing you. So take her advice and tips. Work hard. Everyone loves a grafter. I call my podcast Talent Takes Time for a reason. Don't rush it, but get it right. I hope you enjoyed listening to Anna's episode. If you think sports media is the area for you, I have more tips on my free ebook. Sign up at my website, alisonbender.com, and I'll send it to you. In the meantime, take care and I'll see you soon on Talent Takes Time. Thanks for listening to this episode of Talent Takes Time. The series is written and presented by me, Alison Bender. Gary Hayes produces the podcast with me, and our consultant producers are Neil Pacchietto and Nick Lapworth. Talent Takes Time is part of the Highway 61 network. For more podcasts like this, head over to highway61.media. That's HWY61.media, where you can listen to narrative series across all sports. And remember, if you want some free advice from me and to download my free ebook with tips on getting into the industry, everything is available on my website, alisonbender.com. And make sure you follow me on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. You'll find me at alibender.tv.